WIOX is supported by Freshtown Marketplace in the heart of Margaretville. Open till 9, Monday through Saturday, Sunday till 8, with everything you'd expect in a supermarket, including local and organic foods, gourmet coffees, micro-brew beers and ales, and online shopping. Learn more about online shopping at foodtown.com/shopping. WIOX is supported by the Catskill Mountain News, delivering news, features, arts, entertainment, and sports weekly since 1863. Available on newsstands by subscription or online at CatskillMountainNews.com. Catskill Mountain News, intensely local, uniquely personal.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the TuneIn or FM radio apps. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. We talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight, I've got Andrew Mason, a local bird expert, and Mike Porter. He's the Catskill Forest Association board president, and he's also a birder himself. So what's up, guys?
The birds.
The birds.
They're up, they're down.
They go up, they go down. That's a good one. Well, what we usually start the show off by talking a little bit about what we've seen in the forest since last week's show. So is there anything you guys have seen this last week that had just stood out to you?
Mud?
Mud? Yeah, well, it's been the last 2 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've been out in the woods a fair amount birding, you know, and it's a real good time to be out there because the birds are arriving, you know, the migrant birds, and the leaves are not fully out on the trees yet, which means you can get a decent look at them. So, yeah, it's been, I'd say the last week or 2 weeks have been real good in the woods for birding.
Awesome. Well, I have a Fisher story for you. Two Fisher stories. Well, I was driving to Delhi. This one's a short one. I was driving to Delhi, and there was one dead in the road last week. That was interesting. So Ryan and I pulled over, and we get out, and we're standing in the middle of the road as traffic's going by looking at the Fisher. That's the closest I've ever been to one. But second closest was on Monday, Julie and I were turkey hunting in Fleischman's area, and a Fisher was running through the woods, and there was a stone wall between us and it, and it ran right up to the stone wall about, I would say, 10 feet.
Oh, wow.
It had no idea until finally, Julie was nervous, so I waved my arms, and it finally saw us and took off running the other way, but...
Wow.
It was something cool to see because I've seen them before, but it's always just been a split flash.
You get to see the whites of their eyes.
Oh, I saw very much detail. And it looked at us and had a few seconds of surprise.
I guess I have a story real quick. We're coming home from camp and by McIntosh's auction barn the other day. Becky said, "What's that out in the field?" I said, "Pull into the parking lot." So we pulled in the parking lot and I got my binoculars and we're walking very slowly out in the field. And it was a bird. First, I didn't think it was alive. We get closer and closer and I realize it's an osprey.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I said, "Something's wrong. That osprey's not moving." So we walked out slowly, got within 20 feet of it and found a feather pile. And turns out it was the osprey's tail feathers because he had no tail. And we walked up to him and I said, we could let nature take its course, or maybe we should help this bird. And because it was an osprey, it was something special, I took my sweatshirt off and walked up and gently put it over it and picked it up. And it was nothing like picking up a golden eagle, that's for sure. But it had some injuries on its wing. Called Mike DiBenedetto, and we took it to Missy Runyon. And she looked it over while we were there, and she said, "This bird's in rough shape." Apparently, the first thing that happened was it must have got nailed by an eagle.
Yeah.
And it had holes, some meat missing in the armpit, and a puncture wound that was bubbling air. So she said, this is in trouble. Then the tail was fresh, and she said, that must have been a mammal. There were fang marks. So she had the bird checked out, and they had to put it down. But it was pretty awesome to be that close.
Wow. Yeah, that tells a story.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Wow. No, that's pretty cool. I think I'd seen that bird while I was fly fishing down there earlier than the season.
Yeah, they've been around quite a bit, really.
Yeah. So Andy is our guest tonight, along with Mike Porter on From the Forest, and our main topic is going to be talking about birding locally in the Catskill Mountains. So first of all, Andy, where are you from, and what brings you here tonight with us?
Well, I live in Jefferson in Schoharie County, near Stanford, and my pastime, my passion is birds, has been for many years, and I'm co-president of the local chapter of the Audubon Society, and we're fortunate here to have the Catskill Park, extensive forest areas that are needed by species of birds that are in trouble elsewhere. So our region is pretty important to some of these tropical migrants that need deep woods to successfully nest.
Oh yeah, like what types of birds specifically?
Well, birds like wood thrushes, scarlet tanagers, black-throated blue warblers. One thing that happens with a lot of these birds, a couple things. One is they're affected by cowbirds. Cowbirds are the birds that lay their eggs in other birds' nests, and cowbirds tend to stay around the edge of the forest, and so they don't penetrate deep in the woods. So deeper in the woods, these birds are pretty safe from cowbirds. But out near the edge of the forests, or in if there's breaks in the woods, it'll give cowbirds access. And the same thing happens with predators, especially things like feral cats, foxes. These predators will hang around the edge of the forest, but not necessarily go into the interior. So these big tracts of forested land are secure for the birds.
Is there any types of birds that don't do well because of what you just said, because of the deep forest? There's probably an alternate group of birds, right, that are...
Oh yeah, the different birds use different habitats. The group of birds that's in greatest decline in North America are grassland birds. People don't quite realize it, but birds like meadowlarks, upland sandpipers, henslow sparrows, some of the other field sparrows, those birds really are losing habitat faster than even the forest birds. You know, they their stronghold back before in, you know, pre-Columbian times was the Great Plains. But now the Great Plains is pretty much, you know, a monoculture of corn and soybeans. So there's not a lot of prairie, native prairie left. So the areas that that now support those birds are farm fields in, you know, across the country. But farm fields are not ideal habitat either. They get managed. Hay fields get mowed early, so birds like bobolinks lose their nests. So those birds are struggling for survival. There, a number of them are on the endangered species list or threatened species list. Northern harrier is another one, a raptor that nests on the ground in fields. So, yeah, the field birds probably are the group that's most in trouble. And then in between the fields and the forests, the, you know, the shrubby habitat, overgrown pastures like that, those birds are probably okay. There's a lot of that habitat around still. And those birds, catbirds, some of the warblers, yellow warblers, chestnut-sided warblers, those birds are holding their own. They seem to have sufficient habitat.
You mentioned the bobolink. Where I grew up, there's a 20-acre field right out front. And I noticed they're there every year. But that field is usually the last on the farmer's list to get to. It's about the furthest one away from his barn. So luckily, that never gets mowed, or never got mowed until end of July, sometimes early August. But I did notice that he usually mows exactly half of it at a time, just how he does it. He cuts a straight line down the middle and does the half closest to the road first, and then the next time sunny weather comes, he'll do the other half. But no matter where he mowed, all the bobolinks will leave in the entire field when the first mowing begins. So even though the second half of the field is still tall and safe.
Yeah. Well, that they, you know, they, I don't know if they knew what was coming, but presumably it was something that tipped them off.
Do you think they're still on a nest at that point? Are they still needed the field?
Well, what's considered like the safe date for mowing in this area is about July 15th. So if this was late July, they probably were okay. You know, they probably had gotten the young out of the nest.
I mean, sometimes I guess he mows earlier, but very rarely. He's usually late getting to that one.
Yeah, well, that's good, and that may serve as a sink, you know, as an area where birds can reproduce and then spread out to other fields, even if the other fields are mowed. I mean, it's true. There are, you see bobolinks every year in fields that are mowed early. And so they do come back. Whether they survive or not is, you know, the nests survive or not is questionable. But they do seem to show up. I guess there's enough fields that make it through to keep the population there.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that I've understood with the bobolinks up by where our camp is in Andes, there's several fields that are only mowed like once every 3 years. It's like perfect.
Yeah.
And there's always bobolinks there, and we'll see them. They don't come too early. They got to come a long ways because they come from South America, and they get here, and I think they must start the breeding process right away because by the middle of July, you don't see or hear a whisper from them. And I was riding around the other day, and I noticed fields being cut already.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, wow, that's pushing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, for the farmers, I mean, you can't really wait
to
cut the hay. I mean, the quality of the hay is better early. And, you know, it'd be nice if they waited, but farmers have a tough enough time as it is.
Yeah, you can't
worry about the birds.
Yeah, they got to do their job too, you know?
Yeah. But they, you know, that's kind of a catch-22 with these grassland birds is that the fields do need to be mowed or they go back to
trees,
to shrub, you know? But they can't be mowed too early or the nests are lost. So it's tricky managing them. And some places they are fields are managed specifically for birds, like you say, on a 3 year or 2 year rotation.
A couple years back, I saw a field getting brush hogged. Remember 3 years ago we had a winterless winter. There was no snow. I was watching this series of fields getting brush hogged by this farmer in February.
Wow.
Must have been bored with something to do. And all he was doing was just knocking down the woody vegetation, starting to come into the field and reestablishing it. And I said, that's a great idea. You know, there is no wildlife, hardly any wildlife that's being affected right now.
So. Yeah. Yeah. No, that is good if you can manage that.
But when do we typically have fields ready for a tractor in February?
Yeah, exactly. Right now they're not ready.
Right. So anyway, Andy. So what got you into birding? What got you into all this knowledge that you have now?
Well, back in the 1970s, back in the hippie days, my wife and I took a trip around the country in a Volkswagen van.
All right.
And we kind of just for something to do in the evenings in the campgrounds where we stayed, we got a field guide and a pair of binoculars that we shared. And one of the stops we made was in the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia. And we just happened by serendipity to hook up with an Audubon group there that was going to be paddling into the swamp, and they had a couple of extra seats. So we jumped in, and we went in this dark, dank swamp. And it's a strange place. It's these cypress trees and these weird cypress knees coming up. And we were deep in the swamp, and this little bird flew in and landed on one of these cypress knees right in a shaft of sunshine. And it was a Prothonotary warbler, which is like a golden bird. It looks like burnished gold. And it landed about 10 feet away from us, just sat there in this, like in a spotlight almost. And it just knocked me out. I just could not believe it could be something that beautiful. I had no idea that there were birds like that. So so that's the bird that hooked me, that bird in the Okefenokee Swamp. And from then on, I just, was focused on seeing birds, seeing new birds, and it's continued to this day.
Wow. So what bits of advice would you have to somebody that might want to get into it themselves?
Well, birding is a pretty cheap pastime to get started. That's really all you need is a pair of binoculars and a bird book. And these days, actually, the bird book is almost superfluous because you can get bird apps on your phone for free that have, all the information and more that's in a field guide. The pictures, usually video and bird songs and information and range maps and all that. So really the binoculars, and you can get a pretty good pair of binoculars for $100, you can certainly pay $1,000 and up for a pair of binoculars.
I could think of some many $1,000 pair of binoculars.
But you don't have to have them. You can always move up to that if you stick with it. So yeah, that's the beginning. And there are organized bird walks. Audubon chapter does them. There are bird clubs, other bird clubs around the Catskills. There's the John Burroughs Natural History Society in Ulster County. There's an Audubon chapter in Greene County, the Sullivan County Audubon. So all of these groups, happy to take beginners out on their field trips. Birders, a very outgoing bunch of people, and kind of show you the ropes. Also, a lot of people get started just with bird feeders. That's a very easy way to get a look at some of the more common birds. Just put a bird feeder out, and you'll almost surely get, probably 10 species or so. Chickadees, blue jays, some woodpeckers. The birds don't pass up a free meal. So those are good ways to get started. And, I have to give a little bit of a warning because it can become an addiction.
I know.
Really, there's a lot of travel involved sometimes.
Yeah. When you want to go looking for rare birds, there's people that fly up to the Aleutian Islands at the drop of a hat to look for
that movie, The Big
bird.
Year.
Yeah,
think
exactly.
Of that.
Yeah, I saw that one too. That was a good one. Yeah, where people are trying. Is that a real thing? People are trying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Check
oh, yeah.
off every bird on the list.
There's quite a competition for bird sightings. Whoever can see the biggest life list or the biggest year list, see species, how many species in a year.
Yeah.
Birders are great listers. They have yard lists and county lists and state lists.
I followed a bicyclist who took 1 year out of his life and rode his bike from roughly Portsmouth, New Hampshire, all around the country. Started on January 1st, And he took one entire year and never got in anything that was motorized. And he birded. And he was a top-shelf birder and photographer. And I followed his blog all year long. And he ended up seeing 608 species. No, 613 wow. species by bicycle. Except for a couple kayaks and canoes that he went, like he had to get out into the Pacific a little bit. But that was incredible.
Yeah, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah, and he got hit, he got kind of had trouble in Florida, and I'd done a cross-country trip. So I emailed him through his blog and said, yeah, I've been there. It'll get better. Because he got run off the road or something.
Oh man.
Yeah, and he was just disheartened. I said, don't worry about it. I was disheartened in North Dakota. Not a good place to be disheartened.
Well, definitely birding, like you said, could be a cheap and fun pastime. And I'm not big on birding, but I always do pay attention to the birds around here. I always have a wildlife mindset. But I went to Florida this past February for a week. There was really nothing planned for the trip. We were visiting family and... So I decided to bring, I brought two bird books, I brought a nice camera, and I bought a nice pair of binoculars with me, and it all started on the plane. I was looking for a snowy owl on the runway. So I hear they roost on the runways in Albany, so
yeah.
That's where it started. I had the binoculars out the window, and I did. I made the trip into a little birding trip, and cool. it was a lot of fun. You know,
it's a good place to get your feet wet.
A lot of different shore birds, yeah. and up in the lagoons, could see some different things.
Birds are pretty tame in Florida. The big birds, the wading birds, are pretty tolerant of people.
So where do you go around here in the Catskills to locate birds? Especially, is there any? Well, first, let's start out. Is there anything rare and unique to the Catskills?
Well, I'd say the one bird the birders come to the Catskills for is Bicknell's thrush, which is an endangered species. It's a high elevation bird, and it's found only in the Catskills, only over 3,500 feet. So you got to do some climbing to find it. It's up at the top of Hunter Mountain Plateau. Wittenberg, you know, the high peaks.
Slide has it.
So that's kind of a target bird for a lot of people because it's not, you know, they nest up there and also in the Adirondacks in New England, but that's about it. A little bit in Canada too. And very difficult to catch them in migration because there's so few of them. And they winter down in Hispaniola, the Dominican Republic, and a couple of other, the West Indies islands. So, you know, this is one place you can get to see them. And they are still up there. I don't know how long they're gonna last because the habitat is changing with climate change. You know, the birds that are down below them, some of the other thrushes, in fact, are moving up the mountains and kind of pushing them out. So.
Is that why there's so few of them? Is there they don't deal well with competition?
Yeah, it's just because there's only a limited amount of habitat that's there for them, you know. So I imagine they have never been a real numerous species, but the climate change is definitely affecting them, and so that's one bird. Bald eagles used to be a rare bird, not anymore, but
no way.
People used to come to the Catskills for them, you know, around the reservoirs and the Delaware. But now, you know, you can kind of hardly drive around without seeing a bald eagle these days, which is a wonderful thing. You know, it's a great comeback story. But I think actually bald eagles are still an attraction here. We do a bald eagle field trip in January down to Cannonsville Reservoir in Papacton, and we still get 40-50 people to come on that trip.
Oh,
you
wow.
know, even though yeah. you know they don't need us to show them where the eagles are.
Is it an older crowd that comes on that trip?
It's mixed. I'd say it's mixed. There's kids, there's families. Maybe more older people than younger, but yeah, pretty good demographic mix.
Anecdotally, out of my life, the older family members of mine always will point out every bald eagle they see. And to me, it's like, yeah, okay, it's another bald eagle. I see one every day, or if not every other day of my life. And
Yeah.
And but definitely anybody older than 50 is like, there's a bald eagle right there. It's like, drop everything and let's look at it, which is cool. But it's definitely a different mindset because in their lifetime, and when they were young, there was hardly any.
Yeah. I had a student back in the 70s who really got into bald eagles. We went down to the reservoir and he got enthralled with them. And there was a couple. You'd see a dead deer on the ice and you'd see an eagle. He ended up dealing with Pete Nye, and he was an observer. He had the tracking device and when they were trapping them.
Really?
And he did that for several years. And he ended up even going on a helicopter ride to follow one when it went north.
Wow.
And that was cool. But he still does photography of bald eagles. And he came up one time to one of the trap sites for golden eagles to get pictures. And he got some incredible bald eagle pictures, but no golden showed up. One day we saw a raven down by the reservoir. I said, Tom, there's a raven. He says, so? I said, they're rarer than bald eagles. He didn't care.
No.
But,
yeah. Well, they're pretty special birds, you know, no doubt about it. So, as far as birding in the Catskills is, you know, there's a really good mix of birds, forest birds, wide variety of warblers, several species of thrushes, woodpeckers, flycatchers, raptors, forest-dwelling raptors, broad-winged hawks, Cooper's hawks, goshawks. So, I think, it has appeal to birders who want to see those forest birds, and you're almost guaranteed to find the right habitat for them hiking in the Catskills. It is physically a bit of a challenge in places. Once you get out of the river valleys, you're going uphill for sure. But that's the birds are there.
Well, this is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. we talk about a different forest related topic. Tonight we're talking to Andrew Mason, a local birder, bird expert, and Mike Porter is in the room as well. We're going to ask these guys where their favorite habitats are to go to find these Catskill birds when we come back.
All the things that I would be, I never really looked out quite that far. It's never been a simple thing to see the world with a young man's brain, with an old man's heart, restless soul. Yeah, my family went broke my 18th year. Dad took a job many miles from here. That was all right by me. I was on my own. I had a band, found a job. Life was all right. I worked when I had to. We played all the time on me. Got through that first year of college. All right. But I learned more on the freight docks, driving forklifts on the 3 o'clock a.m. shift in the wintertime. Man, it got cold. Selling guitars on the West Coast, going hungry, chasing ghosts around and around we would go. And I saw it all, tending bar at night, treating saints and sinners right is a good thing to do all the time. You never know talking to, but always know who's watching you. Keep your feet moving straight down the line.
I've known a lot of real good men. Grad school or no school, I've called them my friends. I'm somewhere in the middle, and that's just fine. Though I don't give a damn how much money you make, if your last shirt has pockets, take all you can take. I'm going out with nothing like I came. 'Cause I learned more on the freight docks, dropping forklifts on the 3 o'clock a.m. shift in the wintertime, man, it got cold. Selling guitars on the west coast, going hungry, chasing ghosts around and around we would go. And I saw it all, tending bar at night, treating saints and sinners right is a good thing to do all the time. You never know who you're talking to, it always moves, watching you keep your feet moving straight down the line. But I learned more on the freight docks, driving forklifts on the 3 o'clock a.m. shift in the wintertime, man, it got cold. Selling guitars on the west coast, going hungry, chasing ghosts around and around we would go. And I saw it all, tending bar at night, treating saints and sinners right is a good thing to do all the time. You never know who you're talking to, but I always know who's watching you keep your feet moving straight down the line. Yeah, and somewhere in the middle's just fine. Yeah, somewhere in the middle's just fine.
You're not living on the edge. You're taking up too much room. WIOX, Roxbury.
WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital and Mountainside Residential Care Center, a member of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, offering compassionate care at a CMS nursing home. More information at 845-586-1800. WIOX is supported by the Slighter Agency, on Main Street in Margaretville, a neighborhood independent insurance agency educating consumers about the joys and challenges of owning a second home and about coverage options. Open Monday through Friday, 8:30 till 5. More information at 845-586-2641 or slideragency.com.
This is WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. You're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. We talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight, we've got Andrew Mason, a local bird expert. We're talking about birding locally in the Catskill Mountains. And also Mike Porter from the Catskill Forest Association and local birder is in the studio with us as well. So Mike. There's some things people can do to get involved, especially once they start learning a little more about birding. And there's some surveys that are done pretty regularly. Can you tell us about some of these?
Sure. Probably the longest running count that's done in the country is the Audubon Christmas count. And it's done around Christmas, usually during the 2 weeks or 2 week period after Christmas. And it goes back over 100 years. And how it's done is there are circles established across the country, across the continent, 15 miles in diameter. And the same circles are surveyed every year at approximately the same time. And teams go out and try to find and count as many birds as they can. And the data all goes into a big database. And so it serves to, as a snapshot and a comparison of bird populations in winter, at least. across the country. So our chapter actually does three Christmas counts. One is centered in Oneonta, one is centered in Walton, and one is centered in Fort Plain up in the Mohawk Valley. Then there's also our chapter runs the Franklin Mountain Hawk Watch, which is a fall hawk migration survey. And that's done on Franklin Mountain, which is overlooking Oneonta, the Susquehanna Valley. And we count migrating raptors from late August through the end of the year. We typically get about five to 6,000 birds counted of about 15 or 16 different species. And one of the special species we get on that count is golden eagles. For some reason, it's on the we're on the flyway for golden eagles migrating from their nesting grounds in northern Canada down through the Appalachians. So we often get over 200 golden eagles through the course of the season.
Wow.
Yeah. Next year, there's going to be the beginning of the third Breeding Bird Atlas of New York State. And this is a project that runs for 5 years. And the state is broken up into blocks, the entire state, and people are assigned blocks, one block or as many blocks as they think they can cover. And they go through the different habitats in their block and try to document birds as breeding, various ways to do that. You don't necessarily have to find a nest. You can confirm them by seeing the birds carrying food or see young birds that are recently fledged. And so that project was done in 1980 for the first time, in 2000, and now it's going to be done in 2020, and it'll last till 2025. And so if people are, you know, reasonably good with bird identification, that's a great project. It's very valuable. And it runs, the breeding season starts, well, like March, maybe late February, and runs through into probably the end of July. So it's strictly a breeding birds, and there'll be publicity on that, and I would encourage anyone to get involved with that. It's a big state, and there's a lot of area to be covered.
Wow, okay, cool. And where can they learn more about that?
Well, I think if you Google New York Breeding Bird 2020, Breeding Bird Atlas 2020, you come. There is a website that's just been up recently. And it's going to be a little different this time. The data input is going to be via eBird, which is a Cornell Lab of Ornithology project that allows you to enter bird sighting data on your smartphone or your device. You can do that at any time, but it's going to be used particularly for the Breeding Bird Atlas.
Yeah, I've watched or looked at eBird quite a bit, and there was somebody took the migration of a species over a few years and lit up the eBird map as they moved. It was incredible.
As like a video or something?
Yeah, it was like a time lapse almost of, I forget what species it was, but you can see this thing coming up in mass, you know, all the birds coming up north, and then they hang about a bit and they head south. So they show the whole evolution.
Wow.
It was really cool.
You ever seen like radar data of clouds of birds moving through areas from, you know, the size of New York State or larger?
Yeah.
It's pretty cool to see that.
It is. That's in fact, this spring there were some really good radar images of the migrants coming up. And it's interesting. It's like a donut because the radar goes up at an angle from the airport, and as the birds rise up, they intersect the beam, and it kind of creates a donut around the radar that gets bigger and bigger and bigger as the birds go higher.
Huh.
Quite a phenomenon.
Yeah, I was coming back from North Carolina when my daughter lived one time, and I was driving along on one of the interstates, which turned out to be a mistake because I couldn't stop. And I saw this flock of blackbirds, and that flock of blackbirds went on for 30 miles. And it wasn't wide. It was like just like a along a valley, probably a few hundred yards wide, but it was blackbirds. And I don't know what they were. It was too far up, and I was going too fast. But I watched those for an hour. I said, holy cow. That must have been what it was like to see the passenger pigeons.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So, Andrew, where do you go when where's your go-to places to go birding? You don't have to give
It's not like trout fishing.
Talking about habitats, I mean. Like, where are you going to go?
Well, I mean, if you want to see the biggest variety of birds, I would recommend going to overgrown pasture, shrubby areas that are along woodlands. Because, there's a big variety of birds in the shrubby stuff. Numerous species of warblers and, other birds. And they're usually visible because the trees and the shrubs aren't that tall, so you can get a look at them. And then at the edge of the woods, you do often have birds coming out to the edge out of the forest to forage or just to sing. So you might see a scarlet tanager up there or a rose-breasted grosbeak, the thrushes. In terms of bang for the buck for time spent in the field, I think that's the best, that habitat, field edge meeting woods. Wetlands are always good. Wetlands are very productive. Often waterfowl there, wading birds, as well as songbirds. So wetlands, you're going to always find something.
Is there any specific locations that are just full of birds?
Well, when people ask me the best birding spot in New York, I always say the Bashakill Marsh, which is in Sullivan County. It's along Route 17 near Wurtsboro, and it's a really big marsh. Fortunately, it's owned by the state, and it's accessible. It has an old rail bed running the length of it, and also trails on the other side of it, and some boardwalks and some observation areas. So yeah, and plus some upland areas surrounding it. So the Bashakill, I think, is my number one hotspot in the state. And I'd say it's borderline to call it in the Catskills. It's the Southern Catskills, maybe.
Well, but some people call that the Catskills.
Yeah.
If it's along Route 17, it's the Catskills.
Yeah. That's good. There are other, as far as the mountain, going up the mountain to get the Bicknells, well, Hunter Mountain isn't too bad a climb, if you go up. And you can always take the chairlift. Although it's still a bit of a hike from the chairlift to get up to where the birds are. The climb up plateau is pretty rough, you can, any of those trails up to the high peaks are productive. And areas along the Esopus where there's like around the Catskill Interpretive Center, they got a nice mix of habitats there. They've got a trail that goes up the hillside, and you can get thrushes and woodland birds up there. They also have streamside habitat along the creek and some open fields, so good mix of birds there.
So what is the overall state, do you feel, of birds in the Catskills? I know that might be a loaded question or a hard question. But.
Yeah, well, the majority of bird species in North America are in decline for various reasons. Not necessarily all, not all the reasons are here. The migrant birds have to travel through places that are getting deforested, that are being developed, that are being polluted. The ones that go all the way to South America, the Amazon is under stress. The migrant birds, I think, are at risk. I'd say all the species of migrant birds. Some of the resident birds, red-winged blackbirds, for example, that are not long-distance migrants, robins, those birds, chickadees, the more common birds, I think are doing okay because they don't face that migratory journey so much. And I think there's enough habitat here protected to keep their populations sound. But the large forested areas of the Catskill Park And the forest preserve in particular are very important to these migrant birds for nesting habitat. And it's great that we have that protection here for them. And what the future will hold for them is hard to say. But right now, I'd say the Catskills are holding their own, the Catskill birds. Yeah.
Good. That's good to hear. I mean, is there anything that the average Catskill landowner can be doing in their own woods or their own fields or whatever in general just to improve?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if people have fields, as I said, but the grassland birds are the ones that are in the most peril. So, if someone is willing to manage their fields for birds, those grassland birds, by mowing them, number one, keep them as fields, but mowing them later in the season, you know, after July 15th, so the birds have a chance to nest. That's very good, and especially if it's sizable fields or, you know, in neighboring fields that kind of make up one larger area. As far as the woodlands, I would say if you have a big, big wood lot and you don't need the wood, just leaving it natural is probably the best thing you can do for the forest birds. If you are going to log, selective logging as opposed to clear cutting, trying perhaps to log not during nesting season is wise. And trying to keep your woods intact and as undisturbed as possible.
I've got two questions. One is in regards to the management thing, and that's the Young Forest Initiative. We see that on Bear Spring, and there's been a lot of publicity about opening up land.
I'm not a fan of that, to be frank.
You're not? Okay.
No. I think... The argument for doing that, this is to create, sort of second growth and keep that shrubby habitat on state land. I really think it's just a rationale to increase the population of game species, woodcock, ruff grouse. And those birds are doing all right. I mean, I think that maintaining land in that state, I think, is okay, but to cut down mature woods, mature forest that is benefiting these interior forest birds, just to create that young forest, I think, is not wise. So I think it's been on the part of DEC a little bit of a sales job that really is not in the best interest of the larger bird community of birds.
Okay. The other question, as I was coming up here tonight, and I'd asked John if there was any thrust to the way the presentation was. I says, well, just basic. If you had to comment on what you miss seeing from when you started birding as compared to what you see now that's changed, which has been greater in terms of the evolution, if you will, of the birding populations here?
Yeah, well, it's a little tough to be objective of that, because if something goes away gradually, you don't necessarily notice it that much. Whereas if new birds show up, they're going to get your attention. So I do think there's been declines in the numbers of warblers. And I don't think there's any of those species that have disappeared from this region, but the numbers of birds that show up in the spring, I think, is down. And that's my personal observation, as well as, bird counts.
Mm-hmm.
Those migrant species, I think, the decline is there, even though it's not necessarily fully in your face. A lot of the other birds, I'd say, are kind of holding steady. The birds I was talking about, like blue jays, the woodpeckers seem to be doing generally all right. Robins, chickadees, the birds that come to your feet, or goldfinches, they seem to be holding steady. But there have been new arrivals. Definitely ravens. When I started birding 30 years ago or so, you had to go to the Adirondacks to see a raven.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's plenty of them in the Catskills, and they're nesting all the way down on Long Island, which is just hard to believe, the range expansion of ravens. And another bird similar is merlins, which are a small falcon that, again, when I started birding, there were a very few in New York State, and in the higher areas of the Adirondacks, most of them nested in Canada. And for some reason, over the last few years, they have changed, and they're now nesting in towns, cemeteries. You know, a lot of towns here have one or two pairs of merlins.
Wow.
They've become almost urban birds, a dramatic change in their behavior.
And why do you think that might be?
I really don't have an explanation. It's, you know, there's plenty of prey for them in cities. They get house sparrows, they get starlings. They may take pigeons, although pigeons are a little bit big for them. But certainly mourning doves, you know, feeder birds. But really, I don't know what the change is. They were affected by DDT. A lot of the raptors in the 1950s, 1960s, before the DDT was banned, their populations went down. And, of course, bald eagles have come back, osprey have come back. And that may be part of the merlin thing, too, is that the numbers are just going up, and so they're seeking out new nesting areas. But historically, merlins never really came down this far, but they are here now. And then there are some species moving up from the south. Cardinals are more common than they were when I started birding. Tufted titmouse, red-bellied woodpecker, which is a southern, you know, I've
that's,
always
that's
thought
really
of
new.
A southern bird.
Just the last few years, really.
Yeah, and they're showing up at people's feeders. And I, again, I'm not sure. You know, bird feeding may have something to do with it. You know, I don't know if more people are feeding birds now than they were 20 or 30 years ago, but that can cause bird ranges to expand. And climate change, you know, Carolina wrens are another bird that, you know, a southern bird generally didn't even come north of New Jersey, and now they're up here and nesting, and they can make it through the winters. So, you know, the climate definitely seems to be a factor. So
I look at it like the birds that we're seeing are more dramatic than what we're not seeing. And again, it's you can always see a bobolink somewhere, but you don't see lots of bobolinks.
Mm-hmm.
I see a meadowlark only once every few years.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, those are things that have changed, but they're still here. But I think back, one of the big misses was the evening grosbeak.
Yeah.
When I started birding right here in Roxbury, there was a couple, Stubb and Millie Caswell, and they were sort of on the way to school. I could walk up, and when I was a kid, I'd go up and sit in the dining room and watch the birds, and they were feeding 50 pounds of sunflower seed a day.
Oh, my goodness.
They had
that wasn't cheap.
Quite a budget.
That was, well, it was a lot cheaper back then, but 50 pounds of sunflower seed a day. They had over 1,000 evening grosbeaks. And I started feeding, not on that scale, I was a kid, but I would get 100, 200 at a time. And watching the change in their populations, of course, that's strictly environmental with the lack of the spruce budworm and all that.
Yeah.
And that's pretty well documented, but that was big. But I can also remember when they had a cardinal at their house. People came from all over to see that cardinal.
The cardinal, really.
Yeah.
As I'm thinking about that this morning, as I hear cardinals everywhere.
Yeah.
You know?
They're a common bird here.
Yeah. I mean, it's... excuse me.
Another bird that made a hell of a comeback is wild turkeys.
Oh, yeah.
When I started birding, there were no turkeys.
Oh, no?
And then, you know, there were a few. They reintroduced them, and, you know, you'd hear reports like that. You'd go look for them.
We used to go up towards Plattekill to see wild turkeys because somebody raised them for 4-H project. And over the winter, they were gone. And they'd raise them, get more the next year.
Well, it's hard to drive in the morning or the evening and not see one.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
with deer, my father-in-law was 16 before he saw his first deer, and he lived in Walton.
Oh, wow.
That's, yeah, things change.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I mean, yeah. I mean, my family's hunting club, it was up in the hills of Hardenburg. In 1954, they formed that because there was no deer. All the guys were from Andes, Bovina, and Delhi. And they formed the hunting club there because there was no deer there. And now that's the last place anybody wants to go to go find a deer.
Yeah.
Everybody gets their deer at home and then goes to camp for the camaraderie.
Yeah.
But this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. We talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight has been Andrew Mason. Of he's a local birder in these Catskill Mountains. We've only got one question left. We're out of time already.
Oh, well, I got, if I could just get in this bird walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this bird walk coming up June 15th at the Burroughs Memorial Field. And it's going to focus on John Burroughs' writing. So in addition to looking for the birds, there's going to be readings from his essays about birds. He was a great birder in those days. So that's the 15th of June, 9 a.m. at the Burroughs Field in Roxbury.
Excellent, excellent. So is there a place someone needs to call or go get more information?
It's a state parks program, so I think if you want, yeah, there is a number, 518-827-8690, which
Great.
Is a state park.
They'll be able to get more information there. So the last question I have for you is, what's your favorite bird?
Well, actually, it's an easy one because I get asked that a lot. And what I say, my favorite bird is a red-winged blackbird for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's an abundant species, and I figure if you're going to have a favorite bird, you might as well have one when there's plenty of them around.
You got to be able to see it, right?
Yeah. And also, it's actually one of the earliest birds of spring. They come back before the robins and, before the bluebirds. So they really are a sign of spring in, March. When the first red-winged blackbirds, you hear them, spring's not far away.
That's excellent. Yeah. I love to watch them hover. They get out above a pond, they'll hover for three seconds and then fly back to their bush.
Yep.
But again, this is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about a different forest-related topic. Thank you, Andy. Andy Mason was on tonight talking about birding in these Catskill Mountains, and Mike Porter was on as well, also a local birder. But we'll have to have you on again.
Great. Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Coming up next is Mostly British with Rick Neblung.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long-forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town.